Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys, and I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter at Joy Keys. Also, check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. I'd love to hear from you, so why don't you email me at SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. If you miss a show, you come in the middle, or you're just looking for a particular topic, we're on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Google, as well as here at Blog Talk Radio. So you will not miss an opportunity to catch up on any topic. You can share with friends and family all around the globe. I want to thank you guys for all your support. And this morning, wow, I am so honored to be speaking with, this is a real estate developer. I know you guys are like, what? What are you having a real estate developer on? She's not only a real estate developer. She is a MacArthur Fellow. She's a Peabody Award-winning broadcaster. She's an urban revitalization strategy consultant. She has 8 honorary PhDs. She's been listed as 100 most intriguing entrepreneurs by Goldman Sachs. She has also been Alley 100 by Business Insider, Liberty Medal for Lifetime Achievement by News Corp, and I can go on. Her TED Talk was one of 6 that helped launch their site. She's a Bronx girl through and through. Good morning, Majora Carter.
Good morning. How are you? Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you for calling in. It's a really important topic, and it can be used anywhere in the globe, really, you know, how people can maintain their community, reclaiming their community, which is the title of the book we're talking about today. You don't have to move out of your neighborhood to live in a better one. So that can be used all over. For people who don't know the Bronx, what was it like growing up in the Bronx, and what are some of your fond memories there?
Thank you for asking. So I grew up in the 70s and the 80s, and so it was in the early part, it was absolutely the poster child for urban blight. I mean, I remember watching the 1977 World Series, on television, obviously, and there was a big blimp up there, you know, that would show the aerial shot of the stadium, and there were 3 huge fires burning, you know, in the community not too far from the stadium. And that was because the era of all financial disinvestment, you know, landlords were torching your building. We lost an enormous amount of the population in our communities around that time. And so place known nationally as a place where nothing good could come from or certainly didn't stay there. And so I grew up feeling that and was just like, this is not where I want to be. But
now,
I did
what
have
about
really fond memories?
Yes, I was.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I did have really fond memories because, you know, the people that were left, like my parents who bought their house in the 1940s, and literally the house was practically worthless at the time. I mean, they couldn't sell it, nobody would want it. And but there were plenty of people in our community that stayed. And there was lots of love and care that was really just thrown and supported the children.
Yeah, when you're a child and you're in the middle of something, I mean, you know good and bad, and you, like you said, you saw the fires and you were embarrassed. But then there's other parts of your life that, you know, make it worthwhile, you know, maybe eating ice cream or getting water ice or jumping double dutch or playing hopscotch, all these things that, you know, are in between maybe the crises or traumas that are happening around you, you know.
Absolutely.
And one of the funny stories you have in there is about Jay. But Jay's in there for a reason. The little girl that was in your class. You want to tell the audience about Jay?
That's funny. So when I was going into the 3rd grade and It was a really hard summer, like the beginning of the summer. The 2 buildings at the beginning, you know, at either end of my block burned down, you know, and I watched, you know, people that I know and love were there the day before and were gone the next day. You know, no one died, but as far as I know, but everybody, no one could live there. So my neighbors were gone. The end of the summer, my brother was killed, you know, as a result of the gang violence in the community. And we walked, and so I came to school, and it was just like, I'm still a kid, but obviously trauma is real. And, you know, walked in and I sat next to this young lady that I called Jay, just by the first initial. And, you know, and she was one of those kids who, you know, her parents like would dress her like she had literally a new outfit. It seemed like every day for a month. You know, the first day of school, it was just like, wow, it's like, what kind of fashion show is she going to put on? Whereas I, like, my family, we were really, really poor. And I had, like, my one new, brand new outfit, and I was, like, working it. But anyway, but she sat down, and she told me that she wasn't going to be there much longer because her parents were taking her, you know, up to New Rochelle, which is, like, a suburb north of the Bronx. And, you know, because the neighborhood was getting really bad. And, you know, I was just like, go ahead.
No, I was going to say we all have Jays in our lives. I remember Jays in my school, and my parents were not rich, too. And the whole, like, they always came, like, their hair was nicely braided and greased. And, you know, they were, like, the poster child for, like, blackness. You know, it definitely could have been in, like, you know, Jet or Ebony or something like that.
I know.
I have horrific pictures where I was like, Mom, why did you even send me to school on picture day like that? Like, what in the world? Like this brown, ugly patterned shirt, you know, in the picture. So I feel
still feeling that.
Yes. I made sure my daughter wasn't like that. So that was my revenge, if you will. But the main thing about Jay is that she was moving. And she felt she had to move. Her family felt she had to move to New Rochelle. You also had some cousins who lived in Babylon. Talk about the visits to Babylon.
That was another place, you know, when black folks, you know, moved out of like the inner cities in New York, they often moved to the suburbs and in Long Island, you know, or New Rochelle or even Co-op City, which is way up in the Bronx. And to me, you know, that was the escape. And because if you grow up in a community like this, and this is what I talk about in my book, is that if you grow up in a community like the South Bronx, you're led to believe that you need to measure success by how far you get away from it. And, you know, that is, you know, that's why, but when you leave that, you know, up for grabs, it becomes wherever you're from becomes sort of open to certain levels of predation, quite frankly, when, you know, so you've got predatory speculators circulating, gentrification is something that people, you know, are often, you know, raising the alarms about, displacement. And, you know, what our issue is, it's like, why are we always like measuring success by how far we get away from our communities? You know, why can't we reclaim those communities so that involving the talent that's there to improve our own surroundings and our own economic future?
You know, I was in – oh, sorry, you wanted to say something else?
No.
I was going to say, I have some fond memories of the Bronx because I was in the theater, and I used to go take the 6 train up there to
That's
the
my train.
And it was the arts – yeah, the 6. Oh, my God. I don't know how many times I took that train. But I would go, and we rehearsed with this theater company at this place called The Point. And I
live across the street.
Play.
That's where I first worked there. Yeah, that's where
you first worked there?
To start, yeah, so, that was my first job.
That was, for me, a happy time because I ended up going out the country with their theater troupe. So for me,
which one was
people
it?
Were like, we went to Poland, and then
no.
we
oh,
came
that was
back.
So you worked with Stephen Sapp and Mildred Ruiz?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
Yep.
So we might have met.
So. You
Did
maybe. I don't remember, but we could have. But for me, you know, it was fun. Now, of course, when I would leave at night, everybody's like, okay, be careful. Just go straight to the train. Just, like, walk right down there, blah, blah, blah. And I guess because I had done it so much, I mean, I wasn't cocky or anything, but I was like, okay, nothing's happened so far. You know, I'm cool. And nothing ever did happen, but I would hear stories, you know, about – watching my back and being careful and, oh, you're going to the Bronx, like, ooh, you know. Everybody has a different perception. Go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, I think everybody's got more or less the same one, you know, which is something that, you know, we hear a lot. But there are perceptions that, you know, oh, my gosh, everything must be bad and everybody's going to be, you know, you're going to walk wherever you're going to get stabbed or shot or whatever. And not to dismiss that sometimes, you know, and I mean, my heart goes out to the folks in Chicago in particular, because it is, it's really hard, you know, what they're going through right now. But it cycles, right? It doesn't always stay that way. It wasn't always that way. It's not always going to stay that way either. But in the meantime, you know, I think about, you know, what people would say about our community. And, you know, one of the reasons why I thought it was important to write this book was that, you know, it's like, oh, my goodness, you know, everybody wants to leave a place like that because, you know, it's just bad. Of course, it's super dangerous, blah, blah, blah. And when I decided I was going to be a real estate developer, and, you know, one of the first things I did was ask folks, you know, why are you leaving this community?
Yeah.
And, you know, lots of surveys, lots of focus groups. And it was like, well, what are some of the things that you're leaving for? I mean, and why are you, and crime was not at any of them. None of them.
Mm.
It was more like there was nothing for them to do. Like, there weren't really great places, you know, to hang out. I remember the early days of The Point. Yeah, there was definitely some fun stuff, you know, to do. But there was, most of the things were just sort of like, you know, we've got real, you know, community centers. We don't have, like, you know, cafes and bars and restaurants and, you know, the kind of bookstores that we want to hang out in. And that's why we leave the neighborhood, to go and experience those things. That's where we spend our money.
Also, you talk about property, you know, and the idea of owning property and how can I own the property I'm in and get equity, and that idea of how do you do that? How do you own more than one property? Tell the audience about Miss Odessa. That was a really cool story about her house across from your parents.
Sure. I mean, so the point about all of this in the book, I talk about, you know, Miss Odessa Stratford, and but at the core of it is that, you know, reclaiming your community is about recognizing that there's value in those marginalized communities, and that we can and should, you know, aspire to create a future that's economically, emotionally, and spiritually meaningful to ourselves. And one of the ways that I talk about it is Miss Stratford, who was a woman who lived across the street from my family's house, and you know, she was, you know, a single woman, traveled the world. She was a really interesting woman. Got sick. My family took care of her. She wanted to leave the house to my family, which she never changed her will. And when, you know, other people lived in the house for a while as well, but really my family was taking care of her this whole time. When she finally passed, no one even executed, the will wasn't even executed. Like, nobody cared about actually getting that house. Almost 20 years later, you know, I'm back in the community, you know, deciding that I'm going to be working in community development. And, you know, I asked my dad, so who owns this house? And he was like, nobody. And I was like, what do you mean nobody? And he's like, nobody came to execute. It was like, nobody. And that's it. I was like, oh, I'm going to try to get it, because I needed a place to stay. At that point, I was just living with my family. And I was like, I don't want to do that anymore. I'm too old. And so I ended up, you know, hiring a lawyer, borrowed money, hired a lawyer, ended up, make a long story short, it was really kind of crazy. The second that we had, like, filed a claim, you know, on this house, a predatory speculator obtained a fraudulent deed, you know, on the property, and then tried to evict me, like, right away. And what was interesting about that is that at that time, the South Bronx was becoming what was known as a hot community by real estate developers. And that's when it was just like, oh, there's going to be a land grab, you know, by predatory speculators. And I actually got caught up in one of them. And fortunately, you know, it took 2 years, but I was able to acquire the property, you know, and it's now actually obviously generating wealth for my family, as opposed to the family of the predatory speculators that wanted to, you know, acquire it out from underneath us.
Now, a really cool story also is Xena. Xena is kind of your foray into this activism. Can you tell us about Xena?
Sure. Well, like a lot of what we call low-status communities, or the communities where inequality is simply assumed, where you'll see more environmentally burdensome facilities, you know, more, you know, lower health outcomes, lower educational attainment, things like that. You know, my neighborhood was subject to the city and state looking at it and basically like plant, you know, establishing more waste facilities and power plants and burdensome facilities like that, just basically so that wealthier and whiter communities could afford to avoid them. And so we were literally sitting at a crossroads where the city was planning on doing this. And that's when we decided that we needed to think about, like, what are we actually fighting for in our community? Not just what we're fighting against, but what are we fighting for? And I kept getting these notices about, you know, reclaiming the Bronx River and doing restoration on it. And I didn't even know we really had one. I mean, I knew we had one because you could see it on a subway map, but it wasn't like I've ever like visited it or thought that you can get to it because there was industry that lined the shores. And then, you know, I got my dog Zena literally pulled me into what I thought was an abandoned dump. And there, but behind, like, you know, literally weeds and piles of garbage over my head was the Bronx River. And I took that as an opportunity to work on getting a, you know, a small grant that we leveraged, you know, hundreds of times over into what became a $3 million redevelopment of what's now a national award-winning park called Hunts Point Riverside Park. And, you know, if my dog, my crazy dog Zena, hadn't pulled me into it, I don't think I ever would have gone down that path. But what it led me to show was that if we can, when you change what people are looking at within their community, they tend to have a better sense of pride, you know, within that community and start thinking about it as something that they could, that they want to be in and stay in. And that's really the reason behind my book. It's to support a talent, or at least looking at a talent retention strategy within the community. Which is like, because again, we're taught to measure success by how far we get away from them. And if we continue to do that, then we're not giving ourselves opportunities to be the agents for economic or social change within our own community. Like, why are we consistently going in another direction?
Running away. Now, you try to say, you're doing this, you're trying, I mean, this is in the early part of the game, and people did not like what you were doing and thought you were the enemy. Some of the names, they called you the Pinterest when you were dealing with Fresh Direct, and then you had this phrase self-gentrification, and people took it not the way you wanted them to take it. Can you explain that term self-gentrification and where you got it from and what you were trying to do?
Sure. Well, the phrase was, as far as I know, started by a really amazing gentleman named Dr. Ronald Carter, who was a pastor down and also the head of a HBCU down in Charlotte, North Carolina. And their goal, Johnson C. Smith University is actually the name of it. And what they did, you know, was they were working together with some financial institutions and some local people within the community to do development along the, in the town right outside of the community. Excuse me, right outside the college. And so they were planning to do, you know, housing and commercial development, all that good stuff. And then, but not everybody from the community was involved, of course. And some folks decided that, oh my gosh, like, if, because we're so led to believe, you know, especially in our communities, that if anybody does development, it's got to be people from outside the communities. Like, that's just like the default setting of our, I think, the way most of us think about it. We don't do things like that, you know. And so they were just like, somebody's coming in and gentrifying us out. And Dr. Carter, you know, had to tell some of them, like, whoa, wait a second. No, this is, you know, people from your own community doing this work. It's not gentrification. If it's anything, it's self-gentrification, because this is development that's by y'all and for y'all. So, like, where did that come from? And so I thought that was a really interesting way of just sort of, like, flipping the idea that, you know, why aren't we doing development? Why can't we? And why is it assumed that we don't? It's always, like, somebody else, usually a white person or white company, you know, coming in to do this work. And then we get all upset when it really is not meant for us, or it continues to concentrate poverty and saturate the kind of things that we don't want to see in our neighborhoods. So I thought it was really fascinating. And then, you know, some people, just because it is a trigger word, gentrification is, not the self part, but quite frankly, some of them just didn't see that and just assumed that it meant that, you know, gentrification was a good thing. And you know, it just, it, came to the point where it's like, I don't even use it anymore. I don't even care. It's like, I let my work speak for itself, which is significant. And that's that. And actually, there were those that loved it and thought, yeah, why can't we have nice things in our neighborhood? Like, why do we need to leave in order to experience the kind of beautiful things that we want?
Now, one of the things, you have this phrase in there called poverty level economic maintenance. What does that mean? Tell the people in layman's terms, I guess, you know.
Yeah. Well, no, it is a layman's term. I mean, it's, and everybody knows what it is when they see it. You know, it refers to the type of development that one finds in low status communities. You know, it's like the health clinics, the community centers, the liquor stores, the dollar stores, you know, lots of government subsidized, you know, affordable housing, you know, but just for very, very poor people, and concentrated poverty. That's what you see. So money is definitely being made from each and every one of those kind of entities, but it's not actually helping the people that are already in those communities.
You had a lot of struggle and resistance. It's about money. And one of those was the Spofford Juvenile Detention Center. You had a lot of struggle. And one of the things, not only just because of poverty, but because that you were a woman and you were Black, what were some of the things that happened to you when you were trying to deal with that? Because you had a big shock near the end of like, oh, that's the way you're going to go? You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, you know, our in many low-status communities, the idea is, you know, there's two kinds of development. There's, you know, the kind of gentrification that leads it to a level of displacement. And then there's poverty level economic maintenance. We were interested in doing something that was in the middle. So we were proposing mixed use and mixed income housing, you know, as the play there, that included home ownership, that included, you know, actually taller buildings. It was a much more dense, you know, development. We had included more than 200,000 square feet of, commercial and light manufacturing and cultural space. And it was those things that made it so that we were just like, we needed to economically diversify our community. You know, that would seem like a good middle ground for us, you know, one that wasn't concentrating poverty and all of the issues associated with it, nor was it, you know, displacing everybody in the community by just bringing in, you know, high income, you know, high income housing. That wasn't the point. But I think our city, you know, just really did not see, you know, the kind of inferiority complex that's often, you know, placed upon communities like ours. Like, they were just like, nobody of any means is going to live there. It's like, it's not everybody who lives in our communities, they're not poor either. So right. It was just sort of like, but we're not building, you know, housing for the family who, you know, of people who were born and raised in this community, who raised their kids, you know, and sent them to college, and who have decent jobs right now, who might want to live near their families, but they can't because no one's building that type of housing. They call it workforce housing. And, you know, you're not rich, but you have a job and a career, and you're making decent money. So it's like, why aren't we building for them as well? And I think that's the city not having any confidence, you know, in our ability, or actually the community's ability, to transform itself and actually create the kind of developments that would actually support the people that were in those communities. That was somehow a crazy idea, and instead they chose to build just a low-income housing project.
Yeah.
With no real economic development.
One of the great programs is a Jumpstart program in Philadelphia, my hometown. I was really like, whoa, and I didn't even know anything about this program. So one of the things that I find is that there's a lot of good things going on in the world, but nobody knows about them sometimes. Can you talk to the audience about this Jumpstart program, what they did, what was their goal, and how you got involved with them?
Sure. I mean, the focus of Jumpstart Germantown really is to create a whole host of new developers, and started in Germantown in Philadelphia, and, you know, predominantly Black community, often considered pretty poor, and it was started by Ken Weinstein, who is a really, you know, a commercial developer, actually, from just across the border over in Jersey. And, you know, when he started doing development in a 30-year career development in Philly, and was really excited and was approached by, you know, two young people at some kind of community board meeting. And they just asked him, like, we want to do development in our own communities. You know, can you give us some advice? And he did. He's a really just affable guy. And then he, you know, they told a couple friends, and sooner than you know, there was a bunch of people who were going to this, like, you know, nice white guy who was telling them the keys about how to do development. And, mm-hmm. and it was really amazing for them. And then he did another thing, which was he actually started a loan program that gave these developers their very first opportunity to borrow money to do their developments. So because he knew that none of these folks would have been eligible for a loan, so he set up the conditions so that they would be. And so by creating this, you know, it's just a 4-week program that gives you just enough information on how to get started. And then also once you get through it, you've got access to developing to access to capital, which is the next thing that you need in order to make it happen.
Well, great thing at the end of the book, you have steps that people can take, how to start the process. And that's really what people sometimes are like, okay, you did all this great stuff. Well, how can I do it? You know, and I'm just a lonely so-and-so or whatever, a lowly so-and-so. Can you tell us some of those steps, those process steps that people can do?
Yeah, one of the things that I put in the book is it's a screen that I use myself for the projects that we do. It's called Idea to Reality. And it's basically a way to sort of like pressure test your idea and to figure out like at what point where you need the help and how you need the help. And also even if your idea is going to fly. And so some of the first thing is just like thinking about, you know, is it, you know, it's it just requires definitely some discipline. But the first thing is even just discovering and finding out if you are ready, you know, to make the project happen. And so, like, the first thing is, like, you know, identify a market, your market need. Like, is it a problem that folks really need to be solved? You know, then you need to design your attractive solution, because if it's just a great solution to you and nobody else, then nobody cares. You know, how's it going to be better than what's there? And then you have to find angel investors. And I often put the angel investor in quotes because it doesn't necessarily mean money. It can often mean, you know, some kind of like influencer, you know, or people who like vouch for you. And so that's great. And then you have to launch some kind of a beta test. It does not have to be perfect. As a matter of fact, it never will be. So you work on but you need to see how people use it. And then you learn and refine, you know, based on real world, you know, intelligence, and then move from there. And then you could reiterate and expand. And so, you know, one of the ways that, you know, the way that I describe it in the book is like I talk about what, you know, Dune Lankard, who is a member of the Eyak tribe up in Alaska, you know, what they've been doing around you know, preserving and protecting the land up there so that they can create businesses, you know, using the actual land itself. It's also like a cultural thing that they do up there too. So, you know, it's a really amazing kind of way to just sort of check yourself. But, you know, but ultimately the other thing that I'm excited about in this book is that there's also a discussion guide, because some of the themes are tough for people, to take in. I'm asking people to think about, you know, what would it be like, you know, if people in American low status communities actually stayed and decided, you know, to hold on to the family property or build a business there, you know, as opposed to immediately going to another place the second that they could. And, you know, these are the kind of conversations that I hope we see happen more, because, you know, if you think about it, you know, once in Black communities when we were racially segregated legally and but economically diverse, you know, there were amazing things that happened in those communities. And I think we were there not to, you know, dismiss the kind of systemic racism that we definitely dealt with back then. But, you know, we're still dealing with it now. But I do think that one of the unintended consequences of integration is that once we were able to sort of freely move, you know, to other neighborhoods and move out of those neighborhoods, we lost a lot, you know, and those communities are still challenged, the ones that are left behind. And so I do ask that question, like, why do we seem to measure success by how far we get away from our communities? And what would it look like, you know, if we decided not to and actually stay to reinvest emotionally and things like that, and financially, of course.
I mean, people may not be aware, though, historically, there were very great, if you want to say, not civilizations, but towns, for example, like Greenwood in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and there were many other places, but we don't learn about those, so you don't realize the capability of your peoples, even in those, I would consider, crazier times than now, maybe not, to thrive and be successful. But then when they were torn down. What would you have done differently? What is something you know now that you could tell the younger Majora, like, don't go there, don't go down that street, don't talk to that person? What's something you would do differently?
I would have gotten a degree in in business.
Okay.
Period.
And
that's
do you
what
have
I would
any
have
regrets?
Done.
Do you have any regrets other than that type of thing? Any other regrets of projects you might have worked on or situations you got into?
I mean, I wish I'd, you know, known. Look, you don't know what you don't know, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but, I mean, I have less regrets than I have, you know, kind of just wishes that I had, you know, done some more, like studied a little bit more or even knew what I could study. Because there was just things I just did not know. I mean, I think a lot of folks, I just assumed that, you know, things like, you know, developing our own community, that just wasn't for somebody that, you know, that with my kind of skin tone. You know, I didn't realize that actually there were people who did that, who do that, and there's more of us that can. You know, and I didn't know about, you know, the history, you know, of the Greenwoods and the Wilmingtons, you know, all like literally destroyed, you know, people massacred for actually having, you know, developing their towns that served them, you know, as Black people in some of the most racially, you know, charged and horrifically, you know, this, you know, places, but they did and they thrived. And even that was the thing that pissed people off. That was especially, I think, the thing that pissed white people
that
off.
That was, I think that, exactly. What do you do to take care of yourself? Because there's a lot of stress involved in all these different projects and you come upon a lot of resistance sometimes. What kind of self-care things can you tell people they should do or could do to kind of rejuvenate themselves when they're dealing with this?
I mean, I pray. I meditate. You know, I recognize that I was fearfully and wonderfully made by God, and you know, the little things that I go through are just not that big a deal when it gets right down to it. And you know, and I'm also just deeply humbled and bolstered up by the love I get. Yeah, I get some resistance, but mostly, you know, I get way more love than I do anything else. And it's
what's
because people are starting to
this?
See. Huh?
Oh, sorry.
Say
sorry,
what?
Go ahead. I thought, no.
No,
go
I didn't
ahead.
Hear
I thought
your
you
question.
Had finished. I was going to say, what's
I didn't
next
hear your question.
For you? I was saying, what was next for you now that the book has come out, and what do you plan to do next?
Well, I got to sell the book, so I'm going to let you and tell your listeners that if you do if you buy 10 or more books, I will before March 1st. You know, I can we can schedule a Zoom or depending on where you are, I might be able to come in person. God willing, with all the COVID stuff, actually do a book group with you, which would be wonderful. And you could ask me all the questions you want, and I could, you know, advise you on the projects you're working on. I mean, it could be really fun. And so that's why I definitely want to pitch that. But the next project that we're working on is the restoration of a historic rail station in my neighborhood that we're going to transform into a event hall. And the idea is that it'll be a great music venue. You know, you could rent it for weddings or quinceañeras or sweet 16s or whatever. And, and it becomes like another really functioning, beautiful space in the community. And we're also going to be doing a crowdfunding investment, you know, campaign on that. So people will, you know, from the community will be able to invest in a real estate project with the same rate of returns as a much larger investor.
Now, can they hire you to, like, do training sessions on things? People might be wanting
yes,
to do that. They might want to bring you.
Sure, definitely. Mm-hmm. I work as a consultant, so absolutely, totally. So you can just go to my website, MajoraCarterGroup.com.
Okay, that's what I was going to say. They can go to your website. And where are you on social media? Can you tell them your hooks on social media?
At Majora Carter. And they also have a cafe called At Boogie Down Grind.
I love that. I love the Boogie Down Grind name.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your favorite? We're going to end on what's your favorite coffee?
I really love oat milk, a double oat milk cortado with a little mocha.
Okay.
That's my favorite drink.
Well, thank you so much, Majora, for coming on today. I'm going to be giving away some copies of your book. And maybe people
great.
Will buy the 10. I think the 10 is great.
Great.
That idea is a great idea. Buy 10 of her books.
Yep.
She could do a Zoom talk with you, maybe come talk with you, depending on the COVID, of course, and where you are in the country, in the world. But, I mean, if they have a private plane or something and they want to fly you. Somewhere,
yeah.
I don't think you
should. That'd be
but,
fun.
You know, say no. You know, Dubai or, you know, just putting it out there.
Oh, I'd go.
Yes.
Oh, thank
right.
you
well,
so
you
much.
Have a great weekend. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I just got off the phone with Majora Carter. She's a real estate developer, urban revitalization strategy consultant, MacArthur Fellow, Peabody Award-winning broadcaster. And she has a book I'm going to be giving away. It's called Reclaiming Your Community. You don't have to move out of your neighborhood to live in a better one. She has a great deal going, too. If you buy 10 of her books, she can do a talk with your group on Zoom, or she may be able to come and visit your community group or reading, book lovers, who knows. So buy 10 and see what happens. But you can follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter. You can check me out on Facebook, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and on Instagram, Saturdays with Joy Keys. And if you want to try to win a copy, you can win a copy. Next week, I'm going to be speaking with sociologist Elijah Anderson about his book, Black and White Space. So you tune in to that. And after that, I'm going to have a British singer, a black British singer, Jake Isaac, on. And that's on the 16th. That's a special edition. It's in the middle of the week. So I hope you guys have a great weekend. Stay warm. Drink some coffee, you know, support a black business. It is Black History Month. But you guys know I have black people on all the time. So every day of the year is black history for me. Have a great weekend.
The U.S. Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the Lingo.
GOAT, G-O-A-T, acronym, stands for Greatest of All Time. As in, spaghetti sandwiches for dinner? They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.